Welcome to the greatest and the only podcast I host that's all about immigration. This is Maeve in America. I'm Maeve Higgins. But wait, I'm not in America. I'm in Ireland. Ireland. Isn't my Irish accent really good? I'm going to do this accent for the entire episode because it's a special episode about Annie Moore, a VIP in the history of US immigration. I'm recording this on the day before Christmas, on the quayside of the island I grew up on. And as is my Christmas Eve tradition, I'm speaking quietly to a man in a big felt fedora. He's Dr. Michael Martin, my local historian.
It's ironic that we're standing here today, Maeve, on the 24th of December, when Annie and her two young brothers were at sea in mid-Atlantic Ocean, you know, on this very day in 1891.
Yeah.
And they had left on December 20th from Cove, and they hadn't yet arrived into New York Harbour.
In January of 2014, a girl who had left from Cove and journeyed across the Atlantic skipped rosy-cheeked off an airplane at JFK Airport to start her new life. That was me, compensating for my indoor ghost face with too much blush in a shade aspirationally entitled Orgasm. In January of 1892, a girl who had left from Cove and journeyed across the Atlantic skipped rosy-cheeked off a boat at Ellis Island to start her new life. That was Annie Moore, flushed with embarrassment at the unexpected fuss being made of her by the officials on the island. I know she was rosy-cheeked because the New York Times said so back in the day, but I'm only guessing as to the reason. Like, maybe she wasn't mortified, and the redness was caused by the icy wind whipping through the harbour. Maybe she just lit up with anticipation because she was about to see her parents for the first time in years. She must have felt some relief at no longer being guardian to her little brothers as she had been on their voyage. But why was she written about in the New York Times? And why did the officials on the island give her a $10 silver coin?
She was the very first immigrant to arrive at Ellis Island. And so she kind of accidentally tripped into the pages of history. But by doing so, she became a symbol of really two countries, both of Ireland and America, because she represents the diaspora story and she also represents the immigrant story in America.
That right there is a genealogist who discovered the real story of Annie Moore, the very first immigrant through Ellis Island. It's Megan Smolignac-Smolignac. That's her last name because she somehow managed to marry a man with the same last name as her. Isn't that the coolest way that you've ever heard of taking your husband's name? I wish I could find a Mr. Biggins, and then I'd change my name to Mrs. Biggins Higgins. But that's not important. This is. Megan Smolignac Squared solves history mysteries, and Annie was one she couldn't resist.
Oh boy, I've been obsessed with Annie Moore for almost 15 years now. I'm a bit of a sucker for the historically overlooked, for those who have been neglected, and I think she's kind of a big deal. I think she deserves to be remembered.
I remembered Annie, probably because there's a statue of her in my hometown, her and her little brothers Anthony and Philip. They left from Cove, an island in the mouth of Cork Harbour, and the departure point for more than 2 million Irish people between 1845 and 1945. Cove was the last place Titanic stopped before it, well, I don't want to ruin the movie. Our school trips were to replicas of coffin ships, so named because of the death rate on board as they transported people to America during the Irish famine. That famine, well, it's over now. It's been over, believe me.
I'm actually so full.
Really though? It was a horrific time, between 1845 and 1852, when a million people died and another million left the country, decimating the population of Ireland by about 25%. I'm from an island off an island. So you see, this whole leaving thing, it's in me. And I, too, took the boat to Ellis Island. I took it from Battery Park in Manhattan. It takes about 10 minutes and there's a lot of tourists wearing puffy parkas and sipping hot chocolate.
As they near the end of their journey, these immigrants were greeted by a number of overwhelming sights. Many of these same sights are visible to you today.
I got off the boat and went up the steps to the gigantic hall where Annie was processed. It's crowded and noisy. There's people taking selfies with old luggage for some reason. It has a fabulous shining tiled floor and the ceiling is three stories high. It's an impressive but intimidating first glance at a new country. There's a statue of her here too, but I didn't stop for a photo because I'm no ordinary tourist. I had an appointment with the main man in a quiet spot, the library.
My name is Barry Marino, librarian and historian at Ellis Island National Museum of Immigration.
Barry Marino has the calm, knowing air of a man who's charged with organising the house the day after a giant party. One where you invited everyone and promised them the best time ever, but kind of forgot your promise halfway through and things got really messy. He takes stock of the evidence and figures out what really happened.
She was the first foreigner that the federal government ever encountered for immigrant inspection. They had never done it before. This was a new business for the government. So the idea of an undocumented alien or an the federal government would create all of these things after Annie Moore. And she was their first encounter, and they dealt with her very politely. Yeah. Now, the ones who would walk after her wouldn't maybe often have such a kind welcome. As we see today, things change with immigration, and it gets complex.
Oof, you can say that again.
Things change with immigration, and it gets complex.
Oh, thanks. Immigration services grew into a complicated beast, and it really does get complex, as anybody who has immigrated here or tried to in the last century will tell you. But back to our 17-year-old hero, Annie. What happened next?
Well, the first thing that was needed was that she was relatively healthy. Most immigrants were healthy. There was a cursory medical exam, and that was done by a uniformed surgeon of the Marine Hospital Service. And he would just check, you know, he would check the hands, the face, the skin, the hair, the way the person walked, the expression in the face, just signs of illness. Maybe if it's a woman, is she pregnant? And if so, you know, is she married?
That was part of the check?
That was very important, because if any girl was found to be pregnant but unmarried and never had been married, she was guilty of immorality and would be deported immediately. It's called moral turpitude.
I had never even heard that word before. Moral. What even is that? No, I know moral. Believe me, I know moral. But turpitude, huh?
Turpitude is a formal term. It means depravity, wickedness.
I was caught off guard by this whole deport unmarried mothers thing, because I suppose I was labouring under the idea that this new world was somehow more chilled than the old one. But Barry quickly set me straight.
This is after all, this is European society in a former colonial setting.
Just transplanted. Of their little rules.
It's still Europe. You know, it's really still Christian, Judeo-Christian values.
So just what was Annie leaving behind her in Ireland? I went straight to the horse's mouth, but the horse wouldn't talk. So instead, I asked my local historian back home in Cove.
Okay, my name is Dr. Michael Martin. I'm an historian based in Cove, County Cork. I run guided walking tours, historical presentations in a very interesting and engaging way.
When I spoke to him, I had this weird feeling that I was in the past and the present at the same time. I left Ireland for very privileged reasons, to explore the world, to follow my curiosities, to further my career. I wanted to know why the Irish before me left, especially around Annie Moore's time.
And it's in the years following the famine, the decades following the famine, that you have a huge increase in Irish emigration. What happens in the wake of the famine, in the generations that had survived the famine, emigration became, you know, an everyday option, you know, almost a part of our culture, because those who had survived never wanted to wait around for such a thing to happen again. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that at that time Ireland was part of one of the most affluent nations in the world, people literally starved to death.
Ireland was colonised by the English until the Irish War of Independence in 1922, so Annie and her family never experienced life in a republic or a democracy there. Michael explained.
Well, you know, there are many, many reasons that contribute to the whole culture of Irish emigration. It depends on how far you go back. But many of them in the 19th century would have been residual. I mean, the three main pillars of emigration in the early days would have been religious persecution, political isolation, and what was perceived to be forced economic impoverishment. So you were living in a country where there was, you know, a very, very distinct glass ceiling. And if you were a native, well, then you weren't going to prosper financially or politically.
So what are you going to do?
So it was probably inevitable that people would turn to emigration and reach out to a country where they believed at least that you got on and you generated wealth and comfort from the sweat of your brow rather than your religious orientation or your allegiance to one king or another. I think that's what would have compelled people. You can get on and you can accumulate wealth and generate comfort for your family and friends and so on.
Do you think that bore out in America?
Well, I think it wasn't all they expected it to be.
Now, let's see how Annie got on. She was collected by her parents, who'd come over years earlier with her older brothers, and in a way that many immigrants today still do, had saved up to send for her and her little brothers later. Megan picks up the trail.
They always lived in the Lower East Side. They had a tough, you know, hard scrabble tenement existence.
The Lower East Side of Manhattan is so fancy now, full of art galleries, gelaterias, lingerie stores. I'm no real estate agent, but I can tell you that rents have more than doubled since 1892. But to get that time machine feeling again, I found another historian to give me a tour. His name is Brendan Murphy. He's an education officer at the Tenement Museum and a cool drink of water.
The streets would have inevitably been crowded. The streets would have inevitably been dirty. We are going to have a sanitation department, but we don't have adequate sanitation. And
yeah.
Immigrant neighborhoods traditionally are going to get less sanitation collection than, of course, Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
And so the overcrowding, the fact that we don't have proper amenities, is going to result in a bustling, busy, most likely pretty fragrant street.
Fragrant?
Yeah. But
it still smells, like, not great
around here. Yeah, absolutely. We still have some fragrance. We've got some interesting smells. But Annie Moore also had a beautiful church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really significant because even through all this kind of grime and poverty, there were really lovely places for people to go where you could have faith, have culture, have people who speak your language, know your name.
We peeped into the neighborhood church, St. Mary's. It's a grand old Catholic church with three sets of cherry red doors. Their masses are often bilingual now, the congregation largely Spanish speaking. This church was burnt down by anti-Catholic, anti-Irish nativists in the 1830s. Back on Ellis Island, Barry filled me in on how things were for the Irish here in the 19th century.
Things would change, but in the height of the famine, that's what I'm speaking of, the mass immigration of Catholics from Ireland, they were not looked upon very highly by Protestant America. There was much prejudice against them, and when the Protestant preachers saw that they were unwilling to convert, they would denounce them in the pulpit, and publicly. So there was much animosity and hostility against them, and there was also the reputation because of the poverty, and because of the slums which many of them lived in the Lower East Side along the East River. Also the high rate of tuberculosis from which they suffered. There was a reputation of being unclean, dirtiness. And of course, the Protestants exaggerated these kind of stories and created stereotypes.
The bigotry faced by Irish Catholics was definitely not unique to them. Italians, Eastern European Jews, Poles, all were characterized as other and discriminated against accordingly. There's a famous anti-immigration cartoon from 1909 showing immigrants as rats clambering onto the US shore. They're labelled as murderers, kidnappers, criminals. Today's dehumanizing equivalent could be, for example, a tweet by the president-elect's son, Donald Trump Jr., an image comparing Syrian refugees to poisoned candy. The trajectory of the Irish changed with time and effort, and perhaps with the addition of new groups beneath them in the totem pole of white America.
You know, they got into government jobs, they rose very quickly, and they actually were able to gain control of the Catholic Church in a diocese like New York. And they also became popular in the stage as wrestlers and boxers in the arena. So they actually, and in music and dance and song. So they actually redeemed a reputation through their own creativity and ingenuity and hard work.
Yes! Look at me now, mother! Look at me dance! Watch me wrestle! I'm in Tammany Hall! Oh yeah? I'm a cop! And I'm a priest! And I'm a fancy maid to a lady!
And of course, it doesn't mean that there weren't plenty that didn't do anything. Yeah. There are plenty that were just layabouts. And there were social problems like there are with any group.
Oh, damn. So, we know the reaction that many white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in the US had against the Irish, the Jews, the Poles, the Italians. I was curious about African Americans and the Irish.
And you know, actually, one point where some people would rather hire a Negro maid than hire an Irish maid in the 19th century of America. So, like, black maids were considered much better, reliable, and hardworking, and clean than the Irish weren't. So there was this kind of competition of Irish women and black women vying for similar jobs.
It's the same to this day. I swear to God, if I audition for one more role that goes to Kerry Washington, ugh. No, this is important. I asked Barry if there was ever a sense of community between the African Americans oppressed in their home country and the newly arrived Irish people who'd been oppressed in their home country. Was there at least potential for an affinity between them? Fleetingly, yes. He told me that the communities bonded in entertainment like music and in sports like boxing. But sadly, there were bigger forces working to divide them, like race and class.
Well, the poor were at war with the poor, you know, for resources, mm-hmm. for getting food on the table. They didn't have time to make friends with. Mm-hmm. A group of people that had a completely different culture. One's Roman Catholic, one's Protestant, one's American native, you know, born here, and other is the immigrant who is from a different world, really. But the Irish came in such huge number, and they were struggling so hard in this 19th century. But when Annie Moore arrives, you see, the Irish were in a much stronger position. You know, they had by then become very, very powerful in New York City politics. They had gained control of Tammany Hall, but the Irish were very clannish. The Irish only promoted Irish people. Mm-hmm. They kept everyone else out. They only accepted you if they needed you.
I have such mixed feelings. Like, I'm glad that they made it, but sorry they so often stood on the backs of other marginalized communities to do so. What's happened with immigrants in the 125 years since Annie Moore arrived? Well, a lot. The ban on Chinese immigration has been lifted and the ban on Muslims threatened. Catholic churches are no longer being set alight by nativists, but other minorities are being targeted by people on the same tip.
Ramadan is a sacred time for Muslims, but in one Hayward mosque, prayer has been disrupted by vandals, and police are calling this a hate crime.
Swastikas spray painted, shrubbery set on fire at a local synagogue. This vandalism at Beth Shalom Temple is now being called a hate crime.
The state attorney's office is now calling what happened at the North Palm Beach mosque a hate crime.
Is it fair to say that anti-immigration feeling is as strong as it was in Annie Moore's time?
My mother was born in Scotland, in the Hebrides, in Stornoway, so that's serious Scotland.
So this man, whose own mother moved here from Scotland and walked through the same Ellis Island doors as Annie, campaigned for the presidency by slamming immigrants at every turn. And he won. We're hearing echoes so loud they've become the sound of today.
Thank you.
Let's find out what became of our girl, Annie. Did she go to school? Did she work? Did she fall in love? Barry Marino.
She was a housewife.
She was.
Yeah, she did not go out working. She was a housewife and a mother. She had, I think, something like 11 children or something like that. But she married a German. This is very interesting. She married this fellow, August Scheier, who was a German immigrant and a Roman Catholic.
Ooh, get it, Annie, mix it up. This is what academics call commonplace diversity, when people from different backgrounds form a new community. The tenements of the Lower East Side were no cosmopolitan nirvana, but they did blend America's newest arrivals together in extraordinary ways. We don't know how Annie met her husband. His full name was Joseph Augustus Scheier, and we don't know what he looked like. But I bet he was cute, with shaggy blonde hair and a prominent broken nose, maybe like a nasal-sounding voice and a real slow way of speaking. He sounds really like Owen Wilson, actually. Joseph Augustus worked as a clerk in a bakery. How perfect. I want you to hear this short piece of tape from the Tenement Museum archive because it shows this sense of family that sometimes existed between strangers from different lands. This is Irving Cohen, grandson of Lithuanian immigrant Fanny Rosenthal. When her husband died, Fanny was left alone with her 6 children, and their neighbour, a Sicilian immigrant named Adolfo Baldisi, stepped up to help the family.
He was a wonderful friend to my grandmother, a wonderful man. He helped her out. I can't start to tell you how he helped her out. Did everything in the world for her. He loved her. If she needed something fixed or she needed a favor to get something, Adolf was always there. He says, you tell me what you need, I get. And he never said no. I never heard that man say no.
I am dead. Cause of death? The kindness of strangers. Adolf even taught the young Irving how to shave. He took him in like he was his own son.
In fact, I lived in his apartment when there was no room for me to sleep in the house. He took me in. They weren't kosher, of course. I learned how to eat all Italian food. To this day, I like Italian food because of Adolf.
Brendan brought us inside the Tenement Museum. It's at 97 Orchard Street, and it's an actual tenement house built in 1863. It's preserved just as it was, with burlap and brass beds and exposed brick. It looks a little like the sales section of an anthropology store. Annie lived closer to the river, and she moved around a lot, but always lived in similar tenements. Brendan gave us a tour.
Great question. By the time Annie Moore arrived in 1892, these neighborhoods were really synonymous with poverty. And in this apartment that we're standing in now, this is a completely dilapidated space of 3 rooms, 325 square feet. We have a bedroom, a kitchen, and a parlor. Today in New York, a lot of people stand in here and say, I don't know, I live in an apartment that's smaller than this. And
I paid $2,000 for this in Williamsburg.
Exactly. The exposed brick. the really like quirky window in the middle. Historically, windows and walls were put in to help with tuberculosis. It's to help circulate light and air.
Right.
It's called a tubercular window or a slough window. So even in its name, it's very much giving its function. And then we have to take off our 21st century goggles and put on our 19th century goggles. And to go back and
you
say...
You can't see us doing this on the radio, but we're putting on goggles.
A coal-burning stove that's putting off immense heat, dust. And
you can see the soot. Is that...
Sure. Mm-hmm. We also have no light. Again, kerosene lamps and candles. Very dark and dull in these spaces. 6-7 people trying to figure out how to coexist in here. And having it be full of the very few artifacts that you have, the very few objects that really mean something to you. And we're 4 flights up, and those stairs are not exactly pleasant.
Yeah.
She's got to get that water up the stairs.
Oh, my gosh.
She's got to boil the diapers for her babies. She's got to empty out those chamber pots that are inevitably being used because we have no indoor toilets or indoor plumbing at all. There's one water faucet in the backyard.
I'm just thinking of having any kids in here be... disaster.
And
no TV.
And Annie Moore, no TV.
Yeah.
At all. And Annie Moore coming a few years later, Annie Moore is going to move into a building that inevitably, where it is in the Fourth Ward, is dilapidated, is crumbling, is falling apart. She very well could have toilets still outside in the 1890s.
Yeah.
And then to think about Annie Moore at any given time having multiple children waiting in line for this toilet, or sick with sick children.
Oh my God.
Trying to find space and time.
Or when you're getting your periods.
Or, yes, absolutely.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Nightmare.
The bedroom in the back.
Mm-hmm.
This is the family bed. Family beds are really common.
Oh yeah, I didn't even think about that. That there's like one bed.
Yeah.
Everyone.
One bed for everyone. I mean, the function of a bed is to sleep in it. So you have to imagine that everyone is, as many people are getting in as possible.
Oh my gosh.
And I can't imagine that sleeping was ever incredibly pleasant. Now we have the luxury of sleep training, where you can put the baby in the other room.
Crate training.
Crate training? Is that what we call it?
I just need to jump in here to say crate training is not for kids. Oops, it's for dogs. I got mixed up. But sleep training was impossible with an entire family in one bed. I mean, honestly, everything seems impossible in a tiny apartment with 10 children.
Yeah, which also makes us think about childcare. And childcare for Annie Moore, I can only imagine, was incredibly difficult. You have your oldest child caring for the youngest children, really, regardless of how old they are.
I wondered how Annie fared with all of those babies. Megan filled me in, and it's really sad.
She watched half of them go to their graves by the age of 3, from a variety of different causes, but in one way, shape, or form, they all track back to poverty.
Oh no, those poor babies and poor Annie. I mean, can you even imagine burying your children like that? No, I can't. I tuck that part away in the "she must have been different from us" with fewer feelings folder. That delusional folder in my head that's full of current stories from today, just from far off places that are too sad to bear. Annie died at just 50 years of age. Back on the street, I talked to Brendan about the hardships she faced in her life.
And in reality, knowing what we know about the challenging life, knowing what we know about Annie Moore's life, it's unfortunate that life probably wore on them a lot.
I know. It's such a crazy mixture of hardship, but also resilience. Like, and you couldn't have one without the other, you know? Because, like, there is this story, right, of, you know, immigrants, like, making it and, like, against all the odds. And but it's also, like, why does it have to be so hard?
Yeah.
And, like, today, too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have to be that hard.
Well, and there's that question of, because a lot of that resilience ends up in this kind of idea that because immigrants were able to make it, that immigrants today should just be able to make it,
oh,
too.
Oh, you know, I hate that. I really, that drives me crazy when, like, you know, big chubby white people are like, well, my ancestors had it really hard. Why should we give them? It's like, because we've advanced as a society, because like things are really different now.
And it was that way. And sure, they made it. But Annie Moore died young and lost so many children.
I stood on the darkening quayside in Cove on Christmas Eve and looked at the statue of Annie there. She seemed small and capable, her hands lightly resting on her little brother's shoulders. She's gazing back at a country that she would never see again. An Irish naval ship had returned to the harbour earlier that week from its mission off the Mediterranean coast, a mission that rescued 15,000 people from the sea since May 2015. That said, 2016 was still the deadliest one for migrants crossing the Mediterranean since World War II. Over 5,000 people died. More coffin ships, real ones, not creaky and wooden, but leaking and just as deadly.
I think Annie's experience is typical of the immigrant experience. To me, is fairly universal. These are people who risk everything to strike out in a new place, and hopefully they have good fortune. They often end up sacrificing their lives so that their children and grandchildren can have better lives. I mean, I think about what my own life would be if my immigrant ancestors hadn't left, if they hadn't made the choices they had. And I'm very grateful that they did. You don't realize the ripple effect that your choices have. But for every immigrant, that's doubly so.
On my flight home to New York after Christmas, I just looked out the window and imagined meeting Annie today. Like, what would I say to her? I guess I'd make a pot of tea and just tell her how her family turned out. Because she never made it out of the city, but her descendants are spread right across the country. They're actors and doctors and financial consultants and stay-at-home parents. And they have Jewish and Latin and Asian blood mixed in with her own. Then I'd explain to her loudly and slowly how to rate and review my podcast on her smartphone or tablet. That's our show. Thank you so much for listening. Maeve in America is a joint production of Pretty Good Friends and First Look Media. This episode was produced by me, Maeve Higgins, with help from researcher Emily Alexander. Thank you, Emily. Thanks too to Julie Smith-Clem, Shayna Feinberg, Naomi Westwater-Weeks, Erica Romero, Matt Schiltz, Lital Malad, and Pat Messina Miller, who wrote our theme music. The show was engineered by Cameron Drews and Chris Keane, with music by Sending Letters to the Sea. Special thanks to Gerald Willis and the great folks at the Tenement Museum. Check out our Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Maeve in America for photos of my Annie Moore journey. More immigration stories next week. Oh, I almost forgot to thank the main person, our guest today. Thank you so much, Annie Moore.